Eric Rudolph is no longer just a suspect in a string of bombings across the South. Yesterday, Rudolph agreed to plead guilty to those bombings and directed police to a stash of dynamite and bomb components in the North Carolina mountains. The Justice Department says Rudolph will serve 4 consecutive life sentences for the bombings at the Atlanta Olympics, 2 women's clinics, and a gay bar. In all, 2 people were killed and more than 150 injured. Rudolph eluded law enforcement for 5 years before he was finally arrested in North Carolina in 2003. One of the agents who was looking for him has teamed up with a journalist to write a book, Hunting Eric Rudolph. The 2 authors, Charles Stone of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and CNN producer Henry Schuster, recently spoke with NPR's Debbie Elliott. She asked Agent Stone how the authorities came to suspect Rudolph in the 1998 Alabama clinic bombing.
We were extremely fortunate. A medical college student in Birmingham heard the blast, looked out the window, and saw a person walking quickly away from it. He intuitively thought that was the bomber and followed him on foot and in a vehicle for a period of miles around the city of Birmingham up to the Vulcan statue area on top of a mountain. While he lost him at one given point in time, he went into a local McDonald's restaurant, was talking to the police on a telephone. Another witness in the restaurant overheard the conversation, looked out the window, and saw the person we believe to be Mr. Rudolph walking by. Witness number 2 and witness number 1 both proceeded to get in their vehicles, saw the individual getting into a truck, and that was how we were able to obtain the description and tag number of the truck that ultimately led to the identification of Mr. Rudolph.
So, Mr. Schuster, am I hearing this right? Rudolph was still there as authorities were responding to this crime scene?
Well, yeah. What happened was that the witness calls 911, but different police jurisdictions didn't share the same frequency. So even as he's calling into the 911 system, the man who they identify as Eric Rudolph is leaving one jurisdiction and actually just by walking a few feet in another suburb of Birmingham, which doesn't share the same police radio system.
So that's how he got away in Birmingham.
And then he goes into the woods surrounding there. And the Nantahala National Forest was the area that was both near his house in Topton, North Carolina, and Murphy, North Carolina, where he was living. He had used those woods extensively as a teenager and as a young man. He was growing marijuana in those woods. The woods were essentially his backyard.
Tell me a little bit about what was going on and who he was growing up and the kinds of things that he learned.
Debbie, this is a family that no screenwriter could have invented. His mother was a nun. She left the Catholic Church and she kept going way on to the extremist fringe. She joined a movement called Christian Identity, which believes that the Bible is the history of the white race, that blacks, Jews, Asians are all what are known as mud people. She exposed her children, including Eric, to this when she moved them up to North Carolina from South Florida. And then she took them out to a compound in Missouri where they were exposed to this even more. Now, what's so strange about this is that Eric's younger brother becomes a gay musician in Greenwich Village. Another brother makes common cause with Eric, and he's questioned after the manhunt begins. And then there's Eric, who's hates the government, writes a term paper in high school in the 9th grade about how the Holocaust never happened. Then his mother homeschools him. And, you know, it's fair to say he and his family hate the government, hate the federal government especially.
Now, you both spent time in North Carolina interviewing family and friends, and I guess, Mr. Stone, you were there looking for Eric Rudolph a good part of the time. How were you received by the people there?
I think the media was actually received in many ways better than all the federal law enforcement that showed up. Like Charlie, I grew up in the South. To me and to Charlie, it's a much different place than it was to a lot of the people, both in the media and in law enforcement, who came from elsewhere. They just didn't get it. You can see the pictures even now if you go back and look through the archive tape of law enforcement going through there and they're clad. I mean, it looks like an invasion, submachine guns, full combat gear. Charlie could tell you the story of what happened when they flew the helicopters over Andrews on Sunday morning and then Wednesday night. Now, if you're from the South, you know, that's going to disrupt the folks at church, not just on Sunday morning, but at church suppers on Wednesday night. You just don't do that.
Sometimes I thought some of the people we had thought they were invisible, and they'd meet somebody on the road, and it's fairly common in the South to make eye contact and speak to people. And so we had some cultural conflicts like that, but we were able to resolve them over a period of time.
Charlie was the designated good old boy in the investigation.
Just making sure everybody was polite.
Trying to.
Well, it's remarkable how much the small gestures go a long way.
So let's move forward. It's 2003. Authorities have been searching for Eric Rudolph for more than 5 years, and he's sort of found in a less than dramatic way.
There is something remarkably prosaic about the fact that he was spotted by a rookie cop who was doing a routine check behind a grocery store in Murphy, North Carolina, less than 3 miles from where he had been living before he went on the run, and that he was getting ready to dumpster dive for food. What makes this so interesting and so mysterious is, first, of course, he denied who he was. But secondly, when you look at the mugshot of him from that morning, this is a guy who doesn't look like he's been on what he described as a 5-year camping trip. His hair is cut fairly neatly. He's only got a couple of days' growth of beard. He's not some super survivalist, and that's what makes the mystery of this all the more interesting.
Well, what does that tell you, Mr. Stone?
I think it tells us that everybody, like Henry mentioned, had gotten into the mindset that Eric was living in the woods like a mountain man, when in fact he was more of a true survivalist in that he made use of everything in his environment, including vacation homes and cabins. So I don't have any problem accepting the fact he came into town and could have received help from people. And I'm of the opinion it was unwitting help, that people didn't know who he was, simply because his appearance had been altered so much. And I think if you look at the fact that he was dumpster diving for food, I think that sort of supports the contention that he wasn't getting regular help. If he was, he needed to get a better quality help.
In the book, you frame this as pre-9/11 terrorism case. Can you talk to us about what you mean by that and sort of the climate in which these crimes occurred?
We were only a few months out from Oklahoma City. Waco wasn't that far away. Debbie, I think it's important to realize it is viewed as a terrorism case, a domestic terrorism case. Now, it's gone out of fashion to talk about domestic terrorism because post-9/11, and maybe rightfully so, but because we've tended to forget about domestic terrorism doesn't mean that they've necessarily forgotten about us.
Henry Schuster and Charles Stone, their new book is Hunting Eric Rudolph. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dean.
That was NPR's Debbie Elliott.